Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
My name is Opoka Paropto. My friends call me Chris. Here I am playing a game of Ludo with my family. My son, Azariah Arop, is 2 years old. Although he does not understand the game of Ludo entirely, a winning spirit in him, a competitive nature, does not allow him to accept losing.
I'm going to win this game, you see me here.
And my daughter, Lara Adele, on the other hand, is a very sneaky one when she rolls the dice. So I have to keep an eye on her all the time.
You have some breaks there. You'll not be able to move anywhere.
I am a journalist from South Sudan. I now have asylum in the Netherlands. I feel I have invested so much in my journalism career in South Sudan. The idea that I can never practice journalism at that very high level again makes me very, very sad. The best jobs I can get, I can hope to get anyway, to do with cleaning or working as a warehouse employee. Although the pay is good, but it is not what I am trained to do. So with all my experience, it is somewhat interesting how my CV has changed from being a credible, trusted, hardworking journalist and editor to now doing manual work. However, my ambition is to maintain my current life in the Netherlands, return to my career as a journalist somehow, but also I want to help other journalists who are working back in South Sudan to either stay safe or escape when they must. Welcome to Asylum, a podcast series presented and co-produced by me, Opoka Paropoto, for Develop Audio. This series was supported by the Pulitzer Center. We could start my story at a range of different points, but let's try March 2022. The winter in the Netherlands is starting to come to an end, and although I am struggling in my new situation, at the same time as we are playing Ludo, my old journalist colleague Waja Emmanuel, who is still living back in South Sudan, is being kidnapped, tortured, and poisoned by the state operatives.
Even people that have the knowledge to do investigative journalism are afraid, because how do you do it in an environment like South Sudan that people are, first of all, are afraid to talk, and when they talk, it becomes a problem.
This is Waja. The only way I am able to talk to him is because he escaped his capture. Naturally, we can't reveal exactly where Waja is at the moment, but he is talking from South Sudan and has worked for a whole host of media houses.
Almost every story in South Sudan is regarded as dangerous. You find the newspaper comes out with even one or two pages, sometimes even the front page is empty because those are things that they deem not right.
South Sudan ranks 128th out of 180 countries in the World Press Freedom Index, with journalists facing censorship, threats and intimidation, unlawful arrest and even death.
Journalists are even censoring themselves on minor stories.
We became independent on 9th July 2011. We were a part of Sudan for a very long time. We celebrated independence with punctuated caution, only for a brutal war to explode in December 2013. We have abandoned untapped mineral resources. However, while our neighbors, including Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan, and the Central African Republic, have scored better in development, we have stagnated in South Sudan.
Day after day, things are getting worse, and the state of independence of journalism is definitely diminishing. I remember the threats started as minor, of which I ignored, but eventually got into something bigger.
Being a journalist is not easy. Building a good journalistic reputation is even more challenging. It demands energy, time, dedication, consistency, continuous learning, relearning, and unlearning where necessary. My journey as a journalist involved going from print to community radio for the BBC Media Action, where I was a trainer and a producer, to teaching radio journalism, and then returning back to print. Wojai and I have been friends for years, and we have a rich history working together.
I can vividly remember back in September 2020, I had gone to an extraordinary Council of Ministers meeting.
There was a general sense of panic across the country over the economic situation, and government did not have a clear plan on how to address these challenges.
Because of that panic, people were expecting to hear something from the government. What next is going to happen? So people started sharing this information and waiting for what the Council of Ministers are going to decide. So it got shared around.
Wojai said he was the one that took a photo of the Council of Ministers' agenda and shared it with his news team. Presumably, the danger in sharing the agenda of the Council of Ministers' meeting was in the fact that it exposed the lack of clarity on why the meeting was convened.
And then they started looking for a photo of the agenda and sent to iRadio, and it's published. So they went to the press lounge, and then they asked about the iRadio reporter in the room.
The photo was published to their Facebook page.
I showed up, and then I said, I'm the one. I was left with some media colleagues. Then they pulled me out.
These are security officers who are with the ministry.
I gave them my phone, my recorder, actually everything. So they confiscated all my materials, including my ID, and then they took me into some room.
Wojai is no ordinary journalist, and he definitely is not one of those reporters who copy and paste what politicians and government officials say during press briefings. And he is known for researching issues that he reports about. To ask a question is to be brave, but to follow up stories, to publish damning reports, is quite another thing and comes with risks.
They said, okay, I should wait a bit. I waited for about 20 minutes. They told me I should follow them. I followed them. I was taken now to that compound for presidential security next to the parliament. They took me in. And then at that point, these other colleagues from other media houses, including the Voice of America, and they started chasing them. They wanted the journalists to leave and leave me there. But this guy said, no, we're not leaving until he's released. If you're taking him, you're taking us together.
So other journalists insisted on staying, but they still took Wojai into a room and sat him on a chair.
I said, I'm a journalist. And as you saw, this information was sent to the media house and it has been published. There is no way else it has gone. Said, that is wrong. I am sabotaging on the status of the country. How about if that information was dangerous?
After about 30 minutes at around 7 p.m., they told him to go back home and return around 10 a.m. the next day with one of his bosses. Wojai said, fine. When he started leaving, a white Land Cruiser approached outside.
And one of the guys ordered the security to take me to the car. But they started to disagree. And when they disagreed, I couldn't hear. I didn't know what exactly they were discussing about. But what I knew was that they were discussing whether to take me or not to take me. And then eventually, one of them got so annoyed and started raising his voice, saying, if we arrest this boy, if we take this boy, it's going to be a problem. And his colleagues are here. And that means it will land us into some trouble. So eventually, they went and picked my bag. And then the guy threw it on me and told me I should go.
The issue ended and Wojai didn't hear anything more of it.
I went to the office. I was working on weekend news. So after I finished, I recorded the news and then I left home.
He didn't hear anything for a week or more. It is typical of the national security officers to issue threats but later fail to get official approval to start or continue a case. In most instances, such threats are used as intimidation tactics to send a message that the journalist is being watched and that action can be taken against them anytime.
So as I approached home, I saw a black Subaru car parked next to our gate. As I was almost entering the gate, one of them called me.
At this point, Waja didn't imagine that these people could be dangerous. They were, after all, in plain clothes.
And I said, hey, I started asking that they need a favor. And I said, what favor? That they are going to Rock City residential area, but their fuel has cut them short, and they don't know if I could help them with some money only to put a little of fuel so that they would proceed. Then I told him, no, I'm sorry, I do not have any money. Then he said, it's okay. He just looked at someone familiar and we thought he would help. At around 7 p.m., I got out of the house. There is some clinic within our area. I was going to get some magnesium from that shop. So as I was going, this same car that they wanted fuel showed up again at that point. So these guys came and then they parked the car next to me. And the guy on the left, where I stood, lowered the window. He had a gun, AK-47, on his laps. So he lowered the window and then he said, do you remember me? And of course, I remembered him, but I didn't want to agree that I remember where I saw him. I said, no, I don't recognize you. Then he started saying, I know you. I know who you are. I know who you work for. And I know all your colleagues. He started mentioning the names of my colleagues. And he is here to warn me. If I try any single move, they are going to do something bad to me.
This whole conversation happened in Arabic.
And then the guy behind asked that, are you sure this is Waja Emmanuel? Then he said, yeah, I know him. I know him very well. This is Waja. I think they became a bit afraid of people noticing that they were threatening me. So immediately they took off from there. And then I was just left stranded.
Waja quickly made a U-turn and returned back home.
I wrote to some of my colleagues, including the CEO based in Nairobi.
The CEO was Stephen Omiri.
Sometime after that incident, I decided to leave the family house. So I decided to shift away because I had a thought like maybe my profession and the things that I was doing were exposing my family to some kind of a danger. But the same incidences started, you know, continued happening. I remember one of my female colleagues who works for some media houses in Juba. She actually came up to my place, told me that I am being hunted and that there is an arrest warrant that has been issued against me by the national security.
He found out the date the arrest warrant would be 1st of February 2022. But he thought he hadn't done anything wrong. He was just a civilian and he only told one other person about the pending arrest.
I remember one time, there was a guy who came with a car and then parked at the apartment where I was staying. The car was there for about an hour and it was just parked adjacent to the window side of my house.
On the 25th of February, he left Juba for Kampala.
I started living like a fugitive anyway. So I again shifted from where I was staying.
And on Monday, the 3rd of March, he went to the office.
So after finishing the internal meeting, I made some assigned some few stories to my colleagues. So I left my phone. We have open shoes that we keep around in the office. I removed my shoe and then I put on these slippers and I stepped out.
I used to have lunch at the same place where Waja headed to buy his Rolex, not a wristwatch, but a Ugandan street food, a delicacy, fried eggs with some fresh tomatoes rolled in a chapati. Quite delicious.
This car surfaced from behind and one guy came out of the car. He was gentle, dressed well in plain clothes. And the guy came and he started greeting me. Oh, Waja, how are you? It's been a while. Just like someone who knows who I am.
The guy had sunglasses on and started to hug Waja.
And then in the back of my mind, I was like, maybe this is someone who knows me.
He didn't recognize the voice and just thought he would wait until he removed the sunglasses.
At that point, he pulled a pistol from his waist and then he placed it on my tummy, ordering me to enter into the car.
Finally, Waja asks, "Do I know you?" And the man replies,
"You do not have time to ask questions. It's either you enter the car or we leave you here. And if we leave you here, we will not leave you the way you would expect to be left." So they pushed, me into the car and then closed the door. And inside the car, there were three other guys.
No one around him noticed the pistol or anything dangerous had happened. In the car, Waja was in the middle, sandwiched between one of the men already in the car and the man who had threatened him. Three of them were armed with guns.
They started removing my clothes. They removed my shirt, they removed my belt.
They didn't leave Waja naked, but dressed him in a black jumpsuit and a mask that covered his entire head.
There are these masks that you usually see in movies.
So now he can't see anything.
But now from the movement, because I am familiar with that road and that those areas, I noticed which way we passed. We used the same road that was going from Jebel to Kaston, because there's, I know the number of bombs. Then eventually they reached a certain point where they stopped. And then I was moved from that car into another car that had a siren.
So now he can hear the sound of a siren, which means the car can go much faster and doesn't need to stop.
It went for about 10 to 20 minutes and then we entered into some building. It had a big gate. The car entered inside, then I was removed out. I think it's a kind of a story building because it had some steps. I felt myself being dragged up, so taken inside, and then I was pushed into some room.
Waja can hear there are people in a room to his right, and there is also a pungent smell starting to reach him from that room.
I felt like, could this be like a butchery?
Waja secretly starts to imagine actual people being chopped into pieces. He thought and asked to himself, is that what's causing the smell? He thought, why would they take me to a place where they slaughter animals? It can't be true. It must be people.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But they didn't take him into the room that smelled of blood and human excrete. They instead took him to another room. This room had only one chair.
I was taken inside and then one of the guys instructed me to sit down. I sat down. Sat down for about 10, 15 minutes again.
Then without doing anything, they removed him from the room and took him to the car.
They drove for a very long time. I don't know how many hours. Could be an hour and a half away or maybe 2 hours. So now, this time, they took me into another house. When they took me inside, they removed the mask. The room was still under construction. I sat down, then one guy came with a tape recorder, just like these normal recorders that we use for our interviews. That one is Tascam. I recognized it very well. So he put the recorder on, and then he started asking me, "Who are you? What is your name? Who do you work for? Where are you from? Which tribe are you? Who is your father?"
They wanted to know why he was always so critical of the government. One of them asked him why he was trying to instigate a revolution. Within the presidency, the Cabinet Affairs manages a unit that collaborates with other units in the National Legislative Assembly and the National Security Service. Their role is to analyze reported events by journalists and monitor the social media platforms of critical journalists. Some members of these units, who also have a background in journalism, undergo recruitment and training by the National Security Service to assess the work of critical journalists and activists. Subsequently, the unit compiles its findings and presents them to senior officers. These officers then ask specific questions during interrogations, seeking clarification on the journalist's intentions. They inquire about why certain questions were directed to ministers, the underlying motives behind those questions, and why specific information as conveyed by senior government officials was not published or reported in the news story on the radio.
But I kept silent. I couldn't even answer them because I was literally confused where they start from. So after this guy finishing, he went back and then he came back again with this small bottle of water.
It was already getting dark, which I guessed it was about 7 in the evening.
So this bottle of water had some black substance inside. I couldn't even see properly whether it was black, red, or green. And then he instructed me to take that substance. And when I opened it, it had a smell like alcoholic. So I told him I do not take alcohol and this thing smells alcoholic. He said, here, you do not have a choice to take whatever you take. Even if we tell you to eat feces, you will have to eat. So it was a very tough moment and I was forced to drink the substance. So the whole day I spent it without eating anything, even no water. So my throat was literally dry. So when I took that substance, it literally burnt down my throat up to my intestine. I could feel how hard and, you know, heavy it was.
After taking the substance, Waja starts to feel a little bit drunk, a little bit woozy, a little bit confused.
My head rotating, I couldn't see properly. Like I was just disorganized. I guess I fell off the chair or they pushed me, but I couldn't imagine. And then minutes after I started gaining my consciousness, I found myself on the ground and one leg of that plastic chair that I sat on had broken.
Waja's elbow was injured.
When they got that, I was back to my senses again, but of course not fully. This same guy came back again with a tape recorder and put it on record. And then he started asking me the same questions from the beginning. But now I had to answer him whatever way it crossed my mind, because at that point, the consistency wasn't there. I don't remember how I answered him, but I just answered him anyway. Then they tied my eyes again, pushed me into the car. This time they started driving.
Well, Jack can't see again, but he can feel that the road is bumpy.
At some point, the driver started complaining that the mirrors of the car were breaking off, and because he was hitting trees. That was when I noticed that they were driving in the bush. They stopped the car, got me down, and then now we started tracking on foot.
They take him to a hilly area.
There was one person who was holding me. I couldn't count how many they were, but there were people who were talking in front, and then there were people who were taking me from behind here. I heard a sound of cows baying from a distance, and then they stopped. When they stopped, a gun was fired from the direction where the cows sounded from.
So someone else, not in their group, has fired a shot at them.
So when the gun was fired, they also responded. And then they started disagreeing among themselves. Why do you fire? Why do you shoot? Then one of the guys said, but this was shooting at us. Why shouldn't we shoot back at them? So as they were disagreeing, the gunfire intensified at that process. And they started shooting. At some point, I felt free. Like my hands were left. No one was holding me.
He started running blindfolded into the night.
So at that point, the only thing that came into my mind was to just take off, to just run. I couldn't see and it was already dark. If they shoot at me or if a bullet gets me on the process, maybe that is my day. Because all I had in my mind was that these people are going to kill me. And so what is the point of waiting for them to just kill me in cold blood? Let me just take off and see what happens.
Eventually, he hits his hand on a tree and it falls on his head. It was only then that he realized he could pull the mask off his head, but it was pitch dark, so it didn't help much.
I was running with my hands in the front. You know, running like a blind person where you always put your hands in the front to protect your eyes. The gunshot was still going on. I ran for some minutes and then I fell into a stream of water. It was literally after, like, my neck. But I couldn't swim because I had a feeling like maybe these were chasing me. If I swim, I would make sound and maybe they would hear. So I crossed the river on my foot to the other side. I had the jumpsuit on me. So it was because of the water, it got heavy. I removed it. I was now bare-chested at that point. I kept running. I crossed the road. I kept running. I followed the road for about some minutes, and then I saw a motorcycle coming from behind. So I asked that I wanted to go to Juba, and I don't know whether I'm taking the right direction. And I think maybe because he saw me, I was dirty, I was barefooted, bare-chested. He thought maybe I am a madman, I don't know. Because he didn't give me an accurate answer. So I kept running. And then I found one who said was locking up his shop. I went to him and then I said, I don't know whether I'm taking the right direction, but I wanted to go to Juba. He said, where are you from? I had to give him a false answer for him to trust me because of my appearance. I told him, we lost some goats and sheep from home. So they ran to this direction and we've been looking for them all along. So I literally got lost. Then I told him, if you're going to Juba, then Juba is behind you. You have to make a U-turn and run back.
So he went back to running.
At around 11, I reached Lodobo. I reached old mama. She sells bread. So I asked her that I am looking for a nearby police station. Then she said, is everything okay? I said, everything is fine. I just wanted to get into a police station. Because at that point, I still had a fear that maybe this boy is still looking for me. And if I must move, I have to report myself to the police station. So she directed me to the police station.
He was told to sit down and began to narrate his story. Luckily enough, he found someone there whose brother he used to work with. So he had an ally who could take a statement, made some calls, and took him to the hospital. The identities of the kidnappers are still unknown. Woja was blindfolded the whole time, and though he did glimpse occasionally through the cloth, the kidnappers were wearing masks and dark glasses.
I think my only energy that I had was the one that dragged me from the bush to the police station, so... Yeah, I was taken to the hospital, I was examined, they found the substance, but then they wanted to suck it out. But then they said it has spent more than 6 hours and it has already absorbed into the body. It is very hard for them to suck it out. I was given some medicines to regain some energy. The next day, the hospital couldn't treat exactly and couldn't examine the type of substance that I had taken because they did not have what they call toxicology test machine. I felt I needed more further help abroad, so I decided to move to Uganda where I had my treatment.
He was treated at Case Hospital for 3 months for what was found to be poisoning with methanol acid. Woja was given $1,000 by his employer to go towards his medical expenses in Kampala.
The money that they gave me wasn't enough for the treatment that I had to do.
Defenders put in $3,000.
CPJ sent me some money. That was around $1,500 to cater for my services while I am in Kampala. Chris, since I came for the treatment, no single member of iRadio from the management reached out to me to check how I was doing, how the treatment was going until today.
He has subsequently resigned.
I felt so abandoned. I felt so alone that I was fighting a war. I sacrificed a lot of my time to work for them. In most cases, I even sleep at the station to ensure that we do not miss out on any happening from the society. And so when I got this kind of treatment, I felt like it was not worthy of the sacrifice that I had made.
When I was a journalist in South Sudan, I became a target, disliked by political and military elite, and despised by fellow journalists. Notably, my stories on oil and gas reporting, revealing conditions in the oil fields, reporting on war preparations before the December 15th, 2013 war erupted, drew a lot of attention. Additionally, my reporting on SPLA officers blocking food aid in the South Sudanese city of Malakal and urging the South Sudanese president in an opinion piece to sign peace deals sparked controversy. When I started delving into the relationship between President Salva Kiir and Ugandan President Museveni, this all became a red line for many who were close to the president. A few months pass, and then on the 7th of August 2022, I hear that another South Sudanese journalist has been arrested, Ding Magot. She was on assignment covering a protest in Juba for Voice of America. I immediately start to make calls to see if she can be released. You have been listening to Asylum, produced and presented by me, Opoka Parop Oto. Our executive producer is Paul McNally. This is a production of Develop Audio. This series was supported by the Pulitzer Center. I also extend my gratitude to the Evans Foundation in Belgium, particularly its Journalistic Voices Diversified program of 2021-2022. This program facilitated the collaboration of exiled journalists in Belgium and the Netherlands, providing essential support for the resumption, progression, and re-evaluation of their careers. Lastly, a mention of the Center for Victims of Torture in the United States is justified. The CVT has been a lifeline and has allowed me to stay well enough to produce this podcast series. Thanks to the vibrant community of exiled human rights defenders, activists, and journalists, all of whom are an integral part of the RFG magazine family. Until our loud whispers meet again, stay vigilant, stay curious, and ask questions. Every truth seeks refuge as it escapes the jaws of oppression. From a tiny Dutch village called Kokenge in Utrecht, this is Asylum, where exile fuels the fire of inquiry.